It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster, who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Busy, 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 busy week. I've got notes on the end of the G1 climax with one hell of a surprise return to the ring and a devastating injury to end the tournament much the way it began. It started with an injury and unfortunately it ended with one as well. I've got the fallout from Crown Jewel, which will end up being one of the best top-to-bottom WWE shows all year. And the controversy coming out of SmackDown with Charlotte Flair and Becky Lynch. I have a lot of notes on that and a lot of thoughts. Also thoughts on last night's Bound for Glory pay-per-view and last night's AEW Dynamite show. Halloween Havoc predictions, and we may have an answer as to why the NXT Tag Team Champions, MSK, have been booed for months inside the CWC. It's been puzzling to me. We might have an answer now. Plus, my Dark Side of the Ring recap on XPW, which I decided to include as part of the main podcast this week. All that and more on this episode 727 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, October 24th. 2021. If you, yes you, would like to make a PayPal donation and support what I do, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out here on the air. Like the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker Nayef Al-Safar, Big Bear Brian Becerra, Killshot Keith Hart. These are all the members of our Sound Off family here. Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Ostentatious Alan Carter, John Raging Mad Riffle, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, the Pastor of Pain, Damanian Yule, Ass Kicker, Austin Braley, Thomas, Better Than Ben Simmons, Leffler, dropping a dono for the first time this week after, I believe, 7 years in the Facebook group. It took Ben Simmons to inspire him enough to come up with a name and drop a donation. But thank you to Thomas. Bare Knuckle, Brandon Burstian, who is celebrating his 29th birthday tomorrow. So happy birthday to Brandon. And also a very special happy birthday to Sweet Sapphire, Sarah Kittleson, who is celebrating a birthday this Tuesday. So from one Libra to a Scorpio, happy birthday, Sarah. And if you want to become a channel member on YouTube, the place to go is, of course, youtube.com/thesolomonster. That's going to bring up the main channel. And pretty much under any video, you'll see a white join button. Don't know if you could do that on mobile, but I know you can do it on desktop. I want to thank all of our new channel members for supporting on there. We've picked up a whole bunch in recent weeks here in the month of October, so I thank you for that. Let's start off here with Impact. I'm not going to recap every match or anything. I did check out the pay-per-view last night. A lot of people told me I should. It sounded like they may have had a couple of surprises up their sleeve. And I knew the Dynamite was on as well, so I figured, all right, well, I'll just be a slave to the wrestling last night. It's one of the reasons why I knew I wouldn't have time for a stream, so I figured we'll talk about it on the show here. But let me talk about Impact first. Impact held its Bound for Glory pay-per-view last night in Las Vegas. And I have to say, it is depressing to see and to hear how different an atmosphere it is now for these Impact shows. I mean, it's been this way for a while. But just, Bound for Glory has always traditionally been their big annual event, right? Or one of them anyway, one of the top two. I always looked at it as kind of like their WrestleMania, even more than Slammiversary. And to just see the atmosphere now as compared to even how it was a few years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, let alone, a decade ago, you would never even know that this was the same company that did over 2 million viewers at one point on Spike TV. It's just like a totally different promotion now. Matt Stryker was on commentary running down the card at the beginning of the show, and they were piping his commentary in for the rundown over the PA system. And when he got to the title match between Christian Cage and Josh Alexander, he asked the people, how many of you think Alexander is going to walk out as the champion? And maybe half a dozen people kind of clapped and responded. And then he asked, how many of you think Christian is going to leave with the title? And it got no real reaction. And Stryker just goes, this crowd is split right down the middle. That's like, yep. The most unintentionally funny moment of the night was that moment right there. Gail Kim inducted Awesome Kong into the Impact Hall of Fame before the show. They showed highlights of it later on. She made a very nice speech. Her and Gail put that Knockouts division on the map. Before Stephanie McMahon was crowing about there being a women's revolution, there was Gail Kim and Awesome Kong in TNA, and we should never forget that. The Iconics, now going by The Inspiration, made their Impact debuts, winning the Knockouts tag team titles from Rosemary and Jessica Havoc in their very first match. That is a no-go from me. I was not exactly a fan of their act in WWE. Maybe they'll tweak it and it'll be different here at Impact. But look, I'm glad they found work and they got their visa issues settled, because I know that was, you know, a little scary for them. I heard them, it was Cassie talking about that, I think, on Renee Young's podcast a while back. So I'm happy that they found work. But as far as the Iconics as the tag team champions here at Impact, yeah, I think I'm going to pass on that. That Trey Miguel guy, let's talk about him. Trey Miguel, he's pretty good. He's pretty good, isn't he? Yeah, I'd say so. After Josh Alexander gave up his X Division title to Chase after the world title, Miguel won a triple threat to become the new X Division champion, a very good match against El Fantasmo and Steve Macklin, the former Forgotten Son in WWE. He is forgotten no more. Although he was forgotten at the finish because he didn't win. Moose. I was puzzled when they booked Moose to lose to Chris Sabin. He got rolled up by Chris Sabin at Slammiversary. And I remember talking about that. I thought he should have been the one to take that Impact title from Kenny Omega. Here on this show, he won a Call Your Shot gauntlet match to earn the right to challenge for the championship of his choosing. The fucking demon. Not the dead demon that we saw against Roman Reigns falling flat on his face at Extreme Rules. The WCW demon made a surprise cameo in the gauntlet match. I don't know how they swung that one. With Gene Simmons. Somebody got to let Gene Simmons know about that. He might have something to say about that. Good Brothers retained their Impact Tag Team titles over Bullet Club and Finjuice. Mickey James ended the reign of Deonna Purrazzo at 343 days to win the Knockouts Championship. That was a surprise. I was not expecting that. Especially after, you know, Deonna had made so much noise recently about wanting a match with Britt Baker. It almost seemed like they were setting something up. But then who goes over? See, that's the problem if you do a match like that, is that who goes over. But it was a good match. And then in the main event, Josh Alexander, his wife and son in the front row, forces Christian Cage to submit to the ankle lock to win his first Impact World Championship. I said last week, this feels like a title change. It's time for Christian to come back to AEW television. And Christian is not, you know, Kenny Omega, who's going to go out there on TV and win every single one of his matches. And if he's out there losing while also holding the Impact World Championship, I would imagine that Scott D'Amore and the Brain Trust at Impact would not like that very much. And so we did get a title change, and we got a very nice moment with Alexander and his wife and his son in the ring and the whole family embracing. And it looked like they were going to go off the air and have this big feel-good moment. And credit to Matt Stryker and D'Lo Brown on commentary, who sold the shit out of this. Their voices were cracking. They were crying. They were really trying to put this over. And then Moose comes out. He is cashing in. And it is such a tired concept at this point. It's not an Impact problem. It's a wrestling problem. But There he is, telling the referee he's cashing in his gauntlet win to challenge for the Impact World title. Alexander ushers his wife and kid into the corner to get them out of harm's way. So they're still in the ring while they're watching their husband and they're watching their father walk right into a spear. And in a matter of about 6 seconds, Moose pins Josh Alexander and becomes the new Impact Wrestling World Champion at long last, something they should have done months ago. But when he was hot as a babyface, they should have done it. I like this. And I know not everybody probably did. But I like this, and I'll tell you why. First of all, I've been saying that they should have put the title on Moose, and they did. So I'm not going to come on here now and say that I have an issue with it, because I said that's what I had wanted to see. And that's what they gave us here on this show. Would I have done it this way? No. But I do like the fact that they put the championship on him. But second of all, this is the Daniel Bryan story from 2013 at SummerSlam. Daniel Bryan pinned John Cena in the main event of SummerSlam that year to win his very first WWE championship. And people were very happy for him, and he looked like it was going to be this great feel-good moment going off the air. And then Randy Orton came out, and he teased cashing in his money in the bank. And that's when Triple H, who was the referee for the Cena-Bryan match, he was still in the ring. He gave Bryan a pedigree, he turned heel, Orton came in, and he pinned Daniel Bryan in a matter of seconds. It was over. And Randy Orton was the new champion after cashing in his money in the bank. And what it did is it helped establish Bryan as their biggest babyface. Even if they never intended to see the story through originally, in Bryan's own words, at WrestleMania the following year, he was going to be sixth from the top against Sheamus in a match that had nothing to do with any championship. So even if that wasn't their original intent, it set him on his course. Fans got behind him, and he ended up going to the main event and getting his moment at WrestleMania. They have now established Moose as the new top heel in this company after what he did to this guy on this show, and Josh Alexander now has been established as the new top babyface who can chase for the championship. I also thought the image of Moose standing over Alexander as his son ran over to check on, you know, his dad and just his family hovering over him as he laid there. And there's Moose standing over them holding the title. I mean, how old is his son? His son can't be older than 5 or 6 years old. This little kid runs over and tries to check on daddy. That's a great visual. But it's a great way to establish your new top heel for what he did to this man on this show. So I liked it. And there was a lot of talk going into this pay-per-view about Braun Strowman possibly debuting for Impact last night. He was spotted on his way to Las Vegas. He did not show up. I don't even know if he was backstage. I certainly didn't read anything indicating he was there. Now, he still could show up at their TV tapings. They're taping the next few weeks of television in Vegas. Minoru Suzuki is debuting for Impact on those tapings. If Strowman does show up, they may be using the nickname Titan for him, or The Titan. He could be the one to challenge Moose next for the championship. I mean, look, the Iconics came in on night one and they became the women's tag team champions. So who's to say that Strowman wouldn't come in and he wouldn't immediately be thrown into a program against Moose? Maybe they bring him in, not with the idea of putting the belt on Strowman right away. Maybe they're going to bring him in and use him to help elevate Moose. Is that something Strowman would even be interested in? Coming in and being used to help get somebody else over? I don't know. If they can pay his asking price, maybe he'll do whatever they want him to do. As long as he doesn't win the championship. If they want, you know, Josh Alexander to chase for it, then he may not get first crack at the belt. It may go to somebody else. You know, he may have to claw his way back to the top. That's a story that they could tell over the next several months. But I think a Moose run with the belt is long overdue, and I was happy to see him finally get it. The G1 climax ended with Okada winning his third G1 since 2012 with a victory over Kota Ibushi in the finals to earn the right to challenge for the IWGP heavyweight title at Wrestle Kingdom, a finals that had to be stopped early due to injury. It was a G1 that began with an injury to Tetsuya Naito, his knee, which knocked him out of the tournament. And sadly, it ended with one as well, a dislocated right shoulder suffered by Ibushi on a Phoenix Splash that missed when Okada rolled out of the way and he crashed and burned. He landed hard. It looked like he broke his arm. He was holding his arm immediately. He was holding his wrist. So I went from thinking he broke his arm, which is what the announcers thought, to he broke his wrist, to finding out that he actually dislocated his shoulder. So it could have been worse. I think a broken arm would have been worse. But he was just in agony. And Red Shoes didn't waste any time. He immediately called for the bell. He called for an end to this. So he had to know how serious it was right away. I mean, this is New Japan. I mean, guys, you know, they get hurt all the time and they continue on. Red Shoes immediately called the match off. And it looked like they were trying to pop his shoulder back into its socket. And he had to be helped to the back. Not the way that Okada wanted to win, but quite appropriate for what has been a snake-bitten year for New Japan and for Ibushi. I mean, look at the year that he's had. Not only did he won and lost the IWGP Championship, but he had a foot injury. Then he was out with aspiration pneumonia. And now he's got a dislocated shoulder, and I don't know how long the recovery period for that. I would think it might be a couple of months at least. Unless he tries to, you know, come back a little bit sooner, but he's going to be out for a while. Less than 24 hours later, Okada took part in a remote press conference along with the chairman of New Japan. And he was asked about the comments that he made after the show that he wanted to hold the fourth generation IWGP heavyweight belt. That is the previous belt, the one that Okada held many times, that they've replaced earlier this year with a new design. And this is what Okada had to say. Well, I won the G1, and I want to face Ibushi again, but I feel there should be something concrete to represent that. I am not a champion, and I don't have anything to put up. The IWGP Heavyweight Championship that Ibushi retired, though, I'm not saying that people should call me the Exieth Heavyweight Champion or anything, but I want to hold that belt until Ibushi gets back. Usually, the G1 winner gets a contract and defends that. But maybe I can, in fact, since the chairman is here today, and he looked over at the chairman who was standing off to the side, and he goes, I'm asking, to have the fourth IWGP heavyweight title belt in place of a contract, is that okay, chairman? There's usually a briefcase with a contract inside, but after the way things ended yesterday, I want to face Ibushi again. And since Ibushi retired that title, I want it as proof of my promise to him to have a title belt instead of a contract. And so the chairman, Mr. Sugabayashi, he looks over at Okada and he goes, in place of a contract? And Okada goes, that is correct. And the chairman, he just pauses for a long time and he goes, well, you've made your stance clear. Allow time for some consideration. This is the translation from the New Japan website. He goes, allow time for some consideration. And Okada says, understood. Well, if it were to be a contract, last night Tama Tonga came to me after the match, and I have no qualms with putting it on the line against him. But I want to fire up New Japan in my own way, not as the IWGP World Heavyweight Champion, but as the G1 Champion. And Okada was then asked, so to clarify, you would like to forego the current system of holding a right to challenge contract and instead carry the fourth championship belt, assuming the same level of stakes and risks that the IWGP World Heavyweight Champion has. And Okada said, that's right. Until I get to face Ibushi again, and I don't know where or when that will be, but if I have this belt, I plan to keep it until then. I love that belt. So if they wanted to bring it back in some way, I mean, that's great. But if Okada brings that belt back, boy, does that relegate Shingo to second-class citizen status. He is not doing Shingo any favors if he brings that belt back. Just the visual of Okada walking around with that old championship belt. I mean, what are people going to think? They're going to see him with that and think, like, oh, there's your world champion. Shingo's going to end up with, like, a Chris Jericho title reign. So, I don't know. I don't know that that does him any favors. But the big surprise at the G1 finals was the return of Katsuyori Shibata. Nobody knew that he was coming out. The announcers didn't know. They were stunned. It wasn't in their run sheets. Nobody saw him hanging around in his gear. Chris Charlton on commentary was having a mark-out moment when Shibata came out. They kept this very close to the vest. Intermission ends. and Zack Sabre Jr. walks to the ring in his gear, and he wasn't scheduled to have a match. And then Shibata's music hits, and he walks out in his gear for what was announced as a UWF Rules 5-minute exhibition, which was basically a match with a lot of grappling and a lot of submission work and no strikes to the head. Although I take it UWF Rules has meant different things to different promotions over the years. He didn't take any real bumps. Shibata reversed a Cobra twist into one of his own just as the time expired. Both men asked for 5 more minutes like they were Lex Luger and Tatanka at the King of the Ring in 93. And like the two of them, they didn't get their extra 5 minutes. But they shook hands. Sabre left. He gave Shibata the ring to himself to address the fans. And Shibata told the crowd, "The next time you see me in the ring, it will be in an actual match." I don't know what changed, but it's like Bryan Danielson. He was told he would never be cleared to wrestle again in WWE. And 3 years later, he was back. Shibata has not wrestled an actual match since the match with Okada in 2017 where he almost died. I mean, that's not even an exaggeration. The man almost died. He suffered a subdural hematoma from a nasty headbutt that he delivered. Probably it wasn't just one headbutt. That was the headbutt that just sort of, you know, broke the camel's back. But he had to undergo an emergency 5-hour brain operation where part of his skull was removed to relieve swelling on the brain. I mean, for him to come back and look as great as he did in there with Sabre is incredible. Now, he's been training young lions at their LA dojo since he was forced into retirement. So physically, it's not like he hasn't been... He's probably been in the ring grappling and rolling and doing stuff like that. And I'm sure training in the gym, clearly. Looks like he's got himself in great shape. If this is the start of even a part-time return to the ring for Shibata, we might even get to see him in the ring with Danielson at some point. And wouldn't that be something? But please, for the love of God, I say this as a fan and as somebody who, you know, does not want to see a repeat of what happened to him 4 years ago. No headbutts, please. They need to force him to sign that in blood. No headbutts.
Hey, it's Chris Van Vliet. You may have seen my videos on YouTube, but I also have a podcast.
It's Chris-a-mania, brother.
Each week, I sit down with the biggest names in pro wrestling for in-depth conversations to find out what makes the greatest performers so great.
That's a great question. Look at you, man, with the powerful questions.
Just search for the Chris Van Vliet Show wherever you're listening right now.
Ladies and gentlemen, Chris
Shout out to Chris Van Vliet. You heard the man there. A lot of you have probably seen his YouTube interviews, but you can hear them as well. So make sure you check out his recent ones with Adam Cole, Bobby Fish. He just had one that went up the other day with Brandi Rhodes that just dropped on Friday. So search for Insight with Chris Van Vliet everywhere you listen to your favorite podcast. Make sure you add that one to your list. Chris is great at what he does. WWE returned to Riyadh on Thursday for the first time in 20 months for more of that sweet Saudi money and ended up putting on one of their better shows of the year, easily the best of all the Saudi shows so far. Much love to one of our listeners, Fawaz, who had a sound-off sign front and center on the hard cam multiple times during the show, repping the podcast in the Middle East. I love it. Edge and Seth Rollins closed out their trilogy on a high note. I thought that Hell in a Cell match they had was excellent. The best since Sasha and Becky 2 years ago. With one of the greatest table bumps that I have ever seen, taken by Seth Rollins. Redemption for Rollins after his last debacle of a Hell in a Cell match. A match so bad he wanted to literally strangle his boss over it. And that should put him in line for a program with, we're talking about Edge now, Edge's win should put him in line for a program with Big E, because Edge was traded to Raw, and Big E, of course, is the WWE champion. Now, he'll be wrestling Roman Reigns at Survivor Series, because they do this Raw versus SmackDown stuff, but coming out of that, maybe at the, look, they have no pay-per-views in December. They have 2 shows in January, one on New Year's Day, and then you have the Royal Rumble at the end of the month. And on one or both of those shows, you could set up for WWE title matches with Edge and Big E. You know, have Edge put Big E over. Big E's going to need some names to beat. Zelina Vega won the Queen's Crown over Doudrop, ending the worst tournament in the history of this company. One that they could not even devote a full 20 minutes of ring time to. From start to finish, they didn't even hit 20 minutes. While Xavier Woods got to fulfill his boyhood dream of becoming King of the Ring, with a win over Finn Balor, time will tell if this leads to him getting a big head and maybe going heel eventually. I don't see it. You know, for all the times that we've talked about possible heel turns for the various members of the New Day, either together or one guy turns on the other, I don't see any reason for any of the New Day people to turn on each other. I don't think they want to. I don't think they will. I think they want to go down as one of the rare groups that just never breaks up. They're a brotherhood. They're brothers for life. They've had great success. They've made a lot of money. They've sold a lot of merch. Still do. I don't see there being any kind of New Day split where one person turns on the other. Would it make for a great story? Yeah, of course. You could tell a great story. You could tell a great story of jealousy with Xavier or with Kofi. I mean, you can always manufacture some kind of story. I laid out a great story that they could have told with the two of them in the semifinals of this tournament, which they didn't do. But I think these guys are going to end up being babyfaces until they retire, like John Cena. All the years people clamored for a heel turn, we never got one. I think that's what's going to end up happening with New Day. But Woods may be the only person who genuinely cared about winning that crown. I can appreciate that. He's a fan. He has dreamt about being King of the Ring. It's real to him. So good for him. But the King and Queen crowns could have meant a lot more if there was actually something tangible at stake beyond just a plastic crown and a robe and a scepter. You know, they have a breakout tournament in NXT where the winner gets to challenge for the championship of their choosing. I guess for the ladies, their options are limited, but I don't see why they couldn't have done something similar like that for the men, just to have something on the line. Randy Orton and Matt Riddle retained their Raw Tag Team titles against AJ Styles and Omos. And even that felt like, what are we doing here? Why are these two teams still going at it? Why is AJ even still doing tag team duty? And they lost, and I figured, okay, great, finally, we can move on from this. Nope. We've got another rematch already announced for Raw tomorrow night. And I love how they're promoting this show tomorrow night as the start of the new Raw era. I think this is the season premiere. And it's the first night with the new roster. It is a new era, they say, of Monday Night Raw. The new era very much looks like the old era. They added a Falls Count Anywhere stipulation late in the day to the Goldberg-Bobby Lashley match after they came up with a finish of Goldberg spearing Lashley off the ramp onto two tables about 5 feet down on the floor. I thought the finish looked good. Goldberg looked fine. Lashley, you know, predictably took the loss. Goldberg did not deliver on his promise to kill the man, although it seems like Lashley's big push is likely dead. He's lost a whole bunch of times now on TV, and I don't see there being any obvious direction for him. I guess we'll have to wait until this big season premiere, the new era of Monday Night Raw, to see what they might have in store for Bobby Lashley. Big E and Drew McIntyre, they had a very good match with a very predictable finish because nobody in their right mind expected a title change here. I mean, the timing of the draft pretty much ruined that, but they had a very good match. Becky Lynch, Bianca Belair, and Sasha Banks, very good triple threat match where they could have solved a major problem by having Sasha Banks win the championship since she is the only name left on SmackDown and they were wrestling for a SmackDown title. But Becky Lynch retained. And Roman Reigns retained his Universal title, pinning Brock Lesnar after a belt shot and interference by the Usos on the kickoff show. They announced the match was going to be no disqualification, only to come back later on that very same pre-show and reverse that and say, well, Brock Lesnar and Roman Reigns don't want the match to be no disqualification, so it will be a regular match instead. on-the-fly booking at its finest, folks. They should have had this shit worked out before the plane touched down on the tarmac. An hour before the show, they're still trying to figure out what we're doing here. I did like the drama with Paul Heyman sliding the belt into the ring, not knowing who he slid it into the ring for. This is obviously not going to be their last meeting. It feels to me like a Lesnar win at WrestleMania. The problem is that if that happens, we end up with a part-time champion again. And that is never an ideal thing. But that led to SmackDown the following day. That was a long flight for the SmackDown crew. It was a long flight for everybody, but for the SmackDown crew in particular, because they didn't get to go home. They went right to a live show on Fox, which might explain why we got 17 minutes of wrestling on this two-hour wrestling show, or what I think is a wrestling show. They probably did that to give these people a rest, which, if that's the case, I can understand that. Lesnar told WWE.com that he would be coming to SmackDown, and when he finds Roman Reigns, he's going to beat him senseless. They devoted the first half hour plus, I think it was about 36 minutes of this show, to an angle with Roman Reigns. He was in the ring with Paul Heyman. He was refusing to leave unless Brock Lesnar comes out and delivers on his promise to beat him senseless. So they went to a commercial. They came back from the first commercial. Roman is, not only is he still in the ring, he's in the middle of his promo. They come back. He's talking still. And it was a nice hook to keep people tuned in. It was smart. Then Lesnar finally does come out. And they brawled all over the ringside area. He grabbed a television camera at one point. He threw it at Roman, who ducked, and it smashed into pieces against the ring post. They sent referees out to break them up. Lesnar threw a bunch of referees and agents around. Adam Pearce sent the whole roster out to stop him, and Brock took out Humberto. He took out Angel Garza. Welcome to SmackDown, boys. As soon as Lesnar started beating up referees, I knew exactly what was coming next, because they've done this before. And sure enough, after another commercial break, Adam Pearce was in the ring, and he announced that he was suspending Brock Lesnar indefinitely for what he had just done. Lesnar walks back out to the ring. He grabs Pearce by the neck. He was choking him. He's asking him to repeat what he just said. I want to make sure I heard you clearly. Why don't you go ahead and repeat what you just said? And Pearce obliged, and he said, I'm suspending you indefinitely. And he got hit with an F5. The fans chanted one more time, so Brock picked him up and hit a second one, which I guarantee you was not planned. That just felt like Brock being able to read the room and knowing what he's doing and giving the fans what they wanted to see. It was so devastating that he ripped the inseam of Pierce's pants. He split the man's pants. He may have also shit his pants. I know I would have if I was ever threatened by an angry Brock Lesnar. So that's their way of writing Brock out for a few months until the Royal Rumble. You know, the same thing they did the night after WrestleMania in 2015 when Stephanie suspended him for beating up Michael Cole and for beating up a cameraman. That was over 6 years ago. So I guess they looked at that and they figured enough time has gone by. We can go back to that well again. You know, I mean, look, if Brock's leaving, there's no other way outside of him just not appearing on TV at all to plausibly explain why he is not going to be on TV for the next few months. And I like that he showed up pissed off. I liked all of this chaos. I liked the start of the show. You know, just because we went 35 or 36 minutes without a single match, you know, you got the two biggest stars in your entire company, your biggest heel and your biggest babyface. And I think Pat McAfee on commentary at one point made the analogy. It was like Godzilla against King Kong. These guys are just beating the shit out of each other all around the ring. The crowd is hot for it. I liked it. It felt like the sort of thing you would see all the time with Steve Austin in the Attitude Era, where he would come out on Raw, and it wasn't about, you know, what's the first match of the night. You know, that really wasn't the focus back then. It was more, Austin's the hottest thing in all of wrestling, and he's out there. Maybe he got screwed over on a pay-per-view the night before, like Brock did, right? He got screwed over at Crown Jewel. You would expect him to come out the next night and be pissed off and want to beat the fuck out of people. So that's what that reminded me of. As long as you have a compelling idea, Even if it goes through three commercial breaks or two commercial breaks, then go for it. This was more interesting than whatever they probably would have given us. This feels to me like a Brock Lesnar Royal Rumble win. And someone emailed me the other day about this. That maybe the final two left in the ring in the Royal Rumble match are Brock Lesnar and Bobby Lashley. Now, I still think you could get a big singles match out of it, although with Lashley losing more and more, I mean, he's going to lose some of that luster the more he loses. So maybe we get a final two in the Royal Rumble match, and that's as close as we get to a Lesnar-Lashley match. But I think as far as like a Royal Rumble final, in terms of it coming down to two people, that would be a pretty fun way to go. Sonya Deville took over the show with Adam Pearce laid up in the trainer's room, and when Naomi showed up backstage to confront her after that little stunt that she pulled with her in the handicap match last week, and she asked for a rematch, Sonya turned her down and basically just said, get lost. She sent her on her way, and Naomi looked like a fucking geek just walking away like that. I mean, yeah, she's her boss and storyline, I get that, but I am so used to the days of babyfaces actually being badass and sticking up for themselves. And she just looked like a total loser, just walking away from her. This was the first official night of the new roster. So Drew McIntyre was there issuing an open challenge that was accepted by Sami Zayn, who did not have to travel to Saudi Arabia. So he was fresh and ready to go. Didn't do him any good. He still lost. They had a King of the Ring coronation in the ring with Xavier Woods and Kofi Kingston. Nobody interrupted, which was probably the biggest surprise of the night. They ran back Mansoor against Mustafa Ali again, with the same result of Mansoor winning, only this time, unlike in Riyadh, nobody seemed to care. Which leads me to this week's Savage Tweet of the Week. Ryback was at home watching SmackDown because, I mean, what the fuck else is there for Ryback to do? He tagged Vince McMahon and he tweeted, "You can give Mansoor Steve Austin's music and he still won't be over. Holy shit, your product fucking sucks." Now, while he certainly isn't completely wrong in what he said in that tweet, and Mansoor was not over on this show, that's also true, I don't know why he felt the need to single out Mansoor. And Mansoor got him back good by tweeting a screen grab of Ryback's pathetic Twitter poll from a few months ago that I talked about. Actually, I'm sure that one for said tweet at the time. Ryback had put a poll up to see where he wanted the fans to, or where the fans wanted to see him return in 2021. And he listed AEW, NXT, Impact, or Retire. He put retire on there as an option. And retire won in a landslide, 72% of the vote. After which, he tried again, and he included the same retire option because he was clearly just trying to bait people into talking about him. Just to say anything about him, because nobody does anymore. I mean, it doesn't get any sadder than that. So Mansoor took a screen grab of that poll with 72% of the people saying retire, and that was his response to Ryback. So good on Mansoor for sticking up for himself. Hit Row made its SmackDown debut. Isaiah Swerve Scott, Ashanti the Adonis, Top Dollar, and Beef, or as Sonya Deville called him a few weeks ago, Top Dollar. That was during the draft when they drafted Hit Row to SmackDown. We draft Top Dollar to SmackDown. Top Dollar. And BFAB. PW Insider reported that the plan is to push Top Dollar as a single star of the group, with Swerve and Adonis as the tag team, which is the opposite of how it was on NXT, where Swerve was the single and it was Adonis and Top Dollar as the team, which is the way that it should still be. I'm not saying that Top Dollar can't break out as a single star eventually, but I definitely would not be starting him out as one. I would start him out in a team with Ashanti the Adonis. You have the big guy, you have the smaller guy. I think it makes for a good dynamic. I think it gives another tag team in the tag team division, a division that could sorely use new teams. Swerve should, you know, be on his own. Here on this show, it was Swerve and Top Dollar as the team. But if their report is correct, that will not be the case going forward. This was just a quick squash win to establish them on TV. Boy, you know, Top Dollar getting a singles push right out of the gate, being rewarded nicely for all of his recent social media activity, standing up for the company, standing up for WWE. If you just look at the three of them, it's not surprising that Vince McMahon would see more potential in Top Dollar. Some of the members of Hit Row may do well, but they will not all do well. It is just a matter of who makes it and who doesn't. The Hit Row that I loved from NXT is going to look very different in 6 months or a year than it does right now. The main roster has them now. They're going to look very different when we're having this podcast discussion a year from now. Happy Corbin picked up a non-title win over Shinsuke Nakamura. We have new rosters with these two shows. The draft changes went into effect on this show, and we are still getting Baron Corbin wrestling Shinsuke Nakamura. The more things change, the more they stay the same. I hope that this was just to give the people on the Saudi show a rest. And they were short on bodies, and so they just put these two in the ring together. We'll know, because Corbin won. If this leads to a title match and they're going to continue this shit, I'm going to fucking scream. And then, we had one of the worst segments on WWE television all year. A championship belt swap. How exciting. Just saying that out loud gets me so excited I can hardly stand it. With Charlotte Flair and Becky Lynch. Becky, earlier in the show, teased wanting to become Becky Two Belts again. So I thought maybe they had some kind of big swerve planned here for this segment. We had one swerve earlier in the show making his debut. I thought we were getting maybe another swerve here, but that was giving them a little too much credit creatively. Once she was out there, though, I guess Becky must have forgotten everything that she had said, because she didn't seem too concerned about becoming Becky Two Belts. Sonya Deville was in the ring with both women. And they literally just handed the titles over to each other. Well, I mean, to be more accurate, neither woman wanted to give up her belt. Becky went to go grab the Raw Women's title out of Charlotte's hand, and Charlotte instead dropped it on the ground. And then Becky threw her title at Charlotte. Great way to treat your titles, by the way. Let's just throw them away like pieces of garbage. I'm surprised they didn't stomp on them too, or maybe take a dump on them while they were at it. They did more to devalue their two women's championships in this one segment than anything else they have done all year long. Charlotte challenged Becky to a winner-take-all match right then and there, since she wants to be Becky Two Belt so badly. That brought out Sasha Banks. Becky said, "I'll see one of you at Survivor Series," and she left. And the great heel that she is, she got chance of Becky from the crowd. Sasha and Charlotte went at it for a little bit. Sasha hit a Meteora off the ring apron to the floor to end the segment. This was fucking horrendous. They did the exact thing that I said I did not want them to do. And now you see why. No one came out of this looking great. No one came out of this looking any better than they did going into it. I mean, other than maybe Sasha looked great, I guess, in this segment, because she was the last one standing. We still don't know what this means for the lineage of the titles. I assume Charlotte is now a 13-time women's champion. I believe it counted as a new reign for the New Day the last time they did this with them, the belt swap stuff. So it's just another way to pad her bloated title resume and get her that much closer to number 17. These two look like a couple of spoiled brats out there. That's how they came off. That's how their characters came off here in this segment. And yes, they're supposed to be heels. Your women's champions out there looking like a couple of spoiled brats, throwing their belts around and having a temper tantrum. And it was not meant to go down exactly the way that it did. This, according to an initial report that we got from PW Insider. So let's take it back first to Friday night. After Rampage went off the air, which was taped on Wednesday, Andrade had the best match of his AEW run so far. in a loss to Pac. Just a fucking great match. After which, he tweeted, F-U WWE. With a bunch of exclamation points. No context given. Now, I thought, because I was streaming at the time, and I'm being told, oh, Andrade just tweeted, and then I found out what he tweeted. So I'm thinking, okay, maybe this is his way of expressing himself that WWE never allowed him to go out on the main roster and have the kind of match that we saw him have on Rampage. Because it was the best Andrade match since his NXT Championship defense at TakeOver Philadelphia against Johnny Gargano. I wouldn't say it was better than that, but that was as good of an Andrade match as I have seen since that TakeOver match. And that's going back a few years. So I thought, okay, maybe that's what it's about. Because we didn't have any context to any of this. I mean, it just came off as sour grapes. Here's a former WWE guy not willing to let it go. You just had this great match. What the fuck are you going on Twitter for and bashing them? Focus on the fact that you just had this great match. Of course, I was not aware of any of the backstage stuff that was going on at that time and all the reports that would come out later on. But initially, that's what I just sort of assumed that this was about. Then WrestleVotes tweeted that there was more to the story. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, Mike Johnson posted on PW Insider, and Sean Ross Sapp also confirmed, there was a confrontation after the show, a shouting match, when SmackDown went off the air in the back at the gorilla position between Charlotte and Becky. Charlotte reportedly voiced concerns to WWE management earlier in the day about the segment before the show even went on the air. And was very clear that she was worried it might make her look weak. She didn't want to be made to look weak. Nor did she want her title reign to look weak. Despite those concerns, the segment went on as planned. No changes were made. So even Charlotte recognized how dumb this segment was. But of all the women on the roster to be concerned about being made to look weak, it would be Charlotte Flair, the most protected woman on the entire roster. The woman who was going to end up with more title reigns than they had minutes of actual wrestling on this show on Friday. Charlotte is worried that she is going to look weak. Now, during the segment, they had an awkward exchange where Charlotte jerked her title away from Becky when Becky tried to grab it away from her. And in doing so, Charlotte dropped it on the ground. That was not supposed to happen. And then Becky threw her belt at Charlotte, which was apparently planned. Once Flair got to the back, there was a confrontation between the two over Charlotte allegedly disrespecting Becky by trying to make her look bad. That's what one source told Mike Johnson. There were loud words exchanged between the two of them. It never got physical. They didn't start pulling hair. They weren't rolling around on the ground. They weren't trying to put their finishing moves on each other. Fightful said that Charlotte was asked to leave the venue before Becky's dark match was over to avoid any further confrontation. She was then escorted out of the building by a WWE official, which I'm guessing is what led to that tweet from Andrade. His fiance was escorted out of the building. She was escorted off the premises. And then came the tweet from him saying, F-U WWE. I find all of this behind-the-scenes drama far more interesting than anything they have done on television with any of these women. Now, according to Alex McCarthy of TalkSport, the friendship between Charlotte and Becky has been strained ever since Becky called Charlotte plastic during a promo on TV a couple of years ago. And things have apparently been tense between the two of them ever since. I mean, Charlotte today looks unrecognizable from the Charlotte of just a few years ago. Now, to each their own, it's her body, she can do what she wants, but I guess she is very sensitive to people using that word. She recently revealed also to Renee Young on her podcast that she and Becky are not as close as they used to be. So we already knew that not all was rosy. Not that they're enemies, but we already knew that things were not as they used to be. From her own mouth. Between Charlotte and Becky. McCarthy also reported that Charlotte lobbied to lose her title clean to Bianca Belair on Raw last Monday. The two of them had a great match on Raw I didn't get a chance to talk about Raw because what's the point? You know, it was a go-home show to a pay-per-view that I've already talked about. But I did want to mention that. That match with Charlotte and Bianca at the end of Raw Monday night was excellent, with a horrible DQ finish. And Charlotte is said to be, again, this is according to McCarthy, Charlotte is said to be a big fan of Bianca's and thought the finish of that match killed what could have been a big win for her. And that was the point that I was going to make to bring it back to how all of this could have been solved. And by the way, if that's true, hat tip to Charlotte for wanting to do the right thing. It does have to be mentioned, though, in the interest of fairness here, that Alex was the person who Charlotte reached out to a while back to clarify Andrade's pregnancy comments when the rumors were flying around about why she missed this year's WrestleMania. She went to Alex. So if she's a source of his, this could very well be coming from Charlotte herself. This could be coming from Charlotte's camp directly. Paints her in a very rosy light, doesn't it, right? Her lobbying against the belt swap segment, her lobbying to put over Bianca for the belt and wanting to do the right thing last Monday. I'm just saying, we can't discount that as a possibility. Wade Keller on the Pro Wrestling Torch site got his own report up yesterday that the women's locker room in WWE is largely on Becky's side, with one wrestler saying that Charlotte has been increasingly difficult to work with. There was another wrestler who said that nobody wants to work with her. You know, I mean, look, after her program with Rhea Ripley, can you blame him? Look how that turned out. But to bring it back to the whole Charlotte-Bianca thing from Monday night, absolutely the right thing to do would have been to have Bianca Belair pin Charlotte to win the Raw Women's Championship last Monday. And if it is true that Charlotte pitched that very idea and was rejected, this ain't the first time that WWE has made a dumb decision not changing their women's title. Becky Lynch herself admitted in an interview the same thing happened to her last year when she just assumed going into WrestleMania 36, you know, before the pandemic hit, she just assumed that she was going to lose her Raw Women's title to Shayna Baszler. Shayna the Vampire, who had just been called up. Remember that first appearance on Raw where she bit Becky on the neck and she's bleeding all over the place? They were building to Becky and Shayna, who had a dominant run on NXT as the NXT Women's Champion. And Becky just assumed, as a lot of fans probably did, that Shayna is going to win the championship at WrestleMania and they're going to establish her as the new top heel on that brand in the women's division. And then she found out that that was not the plan. And Becky claims that she actually pitched the idea herself that she should lose to Shayna. And she got turned down. She got rejected. So instead, we ended up with a forgettable match between them. And Becky ended up giving the belt up anyway a month later when she found out she was pregnant. And Shayna went on to spend the next half a year tagging with Nia Jax. You talk about wasting 6 months of your career. Or more. It felt like a year. She was tagging with Nia Jax for far too long. But this whole situation could have been avoided. This terrible segment on SmackDown and all the drama that followed could have been avoided by not doing a title swap in the first place. Can you imagine Roman Reigns doing a title swap? You can't picture it, can you? You know why? Because he would never allow it to happen. He would laugh it off. Imagine having Stone Cold and The Rock swap the WWF and the WCW belts if they did a brand split during the invasion. It's too ridiculous to even conceive of such a thing. Now, they wouldn't have to do a belt swap because those belts had neutral names. It's not like even if they had two brands, it was, you know, as long as it wasn't the Raw title and the SmackDown title, then it doesn't matter. That's part of the problem here. But if you can't visualize it for any of those guys, why is it acceptable to have your two top women's champions come out and swap belts like they're fucking Yu-Gi-Oh cards? The solution to this mess would have been to have Bianca win the Raw Women's title on Monday from Charlotte, and then at Crown Jewel have Sasha Banks win the triple threat to keep the SmackDown title on SmackDown. And then, at Survivor Series, we get the proper singles match between Sasha and Bianca that we never got to see at SummerSlam. Raw versus SmackDown. Problem solved. But no. They make a mess, and they try to lick it up with their tongues. instead of using the fucking paper towels that are sitting right over there on the kitchen counter. They're right there. All you gotta do is reach over and grab them. Here's an even better idea. Going forward, so we can avoid this in the future. You don't even need to unify the titles. I don't even think you need to do that. I would much rather see them unify the tag team titles rather than unify these two. You don't even need to unify the two women's titles. Either give the belts new names that don't identify a specific brand, like the WWE and Universal titles, they already do it, or make it so that your champions are not eligible to be drafted. Give the champions draft protection. They earn draft protection by being a champion on their respective brand. A lot of the problems that WWE ends up with are self-inflicted. This is just another example of that. Let's shift over to AEW. The final Saturday episode of Dynamite aired last night. Hopefully the last one for a while. I did not do a stream, so I'll just share my thoughts on the show here. First, though, some notes. Jim Ross was diagnosed with skin cancer this week on his leg. He did not specify what kind, but he said that he is waiting to see what the course of treatment will be, likely radiation. Hoping for the best for JR and that it was caught early. I just had a biopsy done myself at the dermatologist's office a few weeks ago. Get yourself checked. Don't be stupid and take any chances. If you see or feel something that does not seem right, get it checked out. At the time that I recorded the podcast last Sunday, we only had the Fast Nationals that somebody in WWE allegedly leaked. The full numbers came out the day after for the head-to-head battle between SmackDown and Rampage a couple weeks ago. And Rampage, as it turned out, yes, it lost to SmackDown in terms of total viewers, which I knew they would. But AEW did, in fact, beat WWE in the 18 to 49 demo, 328,000 to 285,000. So Tony Khan, in the end, was correct. He did beat WWE head-to-head, but only if you count some of the demos. A lot of the AEW talent had fun with this on social media because the Roman Reigns-Brock Lesnar contract signing for Crown Jewel tied in the demo with the Rampage match between Ruby Soho and The Bunny. The Bunny tied the Tribal Chief. Acknowledge her! On Rampage Friday night, AEW revealed the bracket for the women's TBS title tournament. We've got Anna Jay against Jamie Hayter. The Bunny against Red Velvet. Serena Deeb in a rematch against Hikaru Shida, who is still looking for her 50th win in AEW. And Penelope Ford against Ruby Soho, which took place last night with Ruby advancing to the next round against Chris Statlander, one of four women to receive a bye into the next round. Statlander, Thunder Rosa, Jade Cargill, and Nyla Rose all get byes into the tournament based on their current rankings. They all round out the top five. After Ty Conti, who will challenge Britt Baker for the championship at Full Gear. I've got Thunder Rosa and Serena as the favorites. If Serena wins, see, here's the thing, though. If Serena wins her match against Shida, she faces Nyla in the next round, which makes me think that Shida is going to get her win back over Serena. The only reason I wouldn't have Thunder Rosa win is because I would save her for a match against Britt Baker. I love Thunder Rosa. I think she would make a fine TBS champion, but I see bigger things for her. So, babyface-wise, I could see Thunder Rosa, but I'm going to go with Serena Deeb as my top choice, my top prediction for winning this tournament. Jade, of course, they could give it to Jade, and I mean, she's still very inexperienced, but I could see Jade Cargill win. But I'm going to go with Serena. Dynamite was a fun show last night. I told you not to sleep on that Bryan Danielson-Dustin Rhodes match in the opening round of the World Title Eliminator. I thought that match kicked ass. Bryan wins with a guillotine choke with the body scissors applied. Bryan has been on a tear ever since his first AEW match against Omega, winning all of his matches in different ways. You know, he won here with a guillotine. He's won with the flying knee. He's won with cattle mutilation when he beat Nick Jackson that time. He's just been an absolute joy to watch in the ring. But so is Dustin. Just a really great pro wrestling match. Back-to-back excellent matches going from that Pac-Andrade main event on Friday right into Bryan and Dustin in the opener on Saturday. Darby Allin is still out after being attacked by MJF and the Pinnacle a few weeks ago, so Tony Schiavone brought out Sting to give us an update on his son. But before he could get a word in, MJF interrupted and cut a scathing promo on Sting, joking about all the snow that we see during his entrance being left over from his stash from the 80s, and blaming Sting's negligence for his son Darby, ending up the same way as his other friend, Lex Luger. And he started to say, in a wheelchair, before Sting decked him. Wardlow and Sean Spears ran down to make it 3-on-1. Spears got in some chair shots on Sting. MJF cut a promo on Darby right into the camera while Darby's dad was laying at his feet. And then he hit Sting with his dynamite diamond ring when he staggered back up to his feet. They're setting up for a big pop for Darby's return, which could be in Boston this Wednesday. I thought MJF was great here. Later on in the back, Wardlow went up to him and said, "Look, you and I gotta talk." He was very upset that MJF threw him in harm's way and sacrificed him to Sting. A baseball bat shot the week before from Sting. And I'm glad they didn't just ignore that. I'm glad they brought that up here. And MJF said, "Look, big man, it's not fair that you've got to watch my back all by yourself. It's a full-time job. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to appoint Sean Spears here to be your accountability buddy," is what he called him. Oh, it's coming. The slow build to the split continues. Wardlow is going to make a great babyface. I've always said that. The setup is there, though, for a tag team match with Sting and Darby against MJF and Wardlow at Full Gear instead of a straight singles match if they wanted to do it. I think I would do the singles match. I would do MJF one-on-one against Darby. That's been the issue that's been built up here. It's not really about Wardlow. It's not really about Sting. I would save the tag team match for TV. So do the singles match at Full Gear and then do a tag match with Sting and Darby against MJF and Wardlow. And that could be where the split happens, maybe, with MJF and Darby, or rather MJF and Wardlow. You know, maybe if they do another one of those big Winter is Coming TV shows in December like they did last year, maybe they do the tag match on that show. Ruby Soho advanced over Penelope Ford in the TBS tournament. Not a very good match. She was decent. I want to see Ruby in there with Statlander in the next round and see what they can do. And then if Serena advances, we could get Ruby against Serena Deeb in the semifinals, which I think could be great. Bobby Fish beat Anthony Green. And when the match was over, Fish went and beat him up some more. And that brought out CM Punk, who didn't need his music. Finally, a sensible babyface who doesn't wait for his theme music to start playing before he runs down to the ring to make a save. They waited and played his music after he had already arrived. And Fish bailed out of the ring and was teasing that he wanted, Punk in a match. It has since been made official. It will be CM Punk against Bobby Fish. I'm sure it's going to be a very good match. Gets Punk on TV in a match that he could win. I don't mind having, Bobby Fish beat lower level guys like Anthony Green. Who is he in the match with last week? Lee Moriarty, I believe, on Rampage is who he wrestled last week. He could beat all those guys and then go in there against the bigger names like Danielson and like Punk and just be a very competent, capable wrestler who can go in there and feed them wins and put them over, because it's not about Bobby Fish. Bobby Fish is not the star here. Danielson is. CM Punk is. People like Hangman Page and Darby, those are the stars. Bobby Fish is someone who can go in there, give you a good match, put you over. I have no problem with them using him in that role. Anthony Green, by the way, was not the only former 205 Live name featured on this show. Tony Nese, former Cruiserweight champion in WWE, he was shown multiple times on camera sitting in the crowd through, I would say, the first half of the show, and is said to be working the dark tapings this weekend, so he may have already signed a deal. He probably did. I mean, the way they were acknowledging him on TV as one of the hottest free agents in wrestling, I don't think they'd be doing that if he probably didn't already have some kind of a contract or some kind of agreement with them. There was a very scary moment in the World Title Eliminator first round match between Lance Archer and Eddie Kingston, where Archer came off the top rope for a moonsault. And Eddie rolled out of the way, and Archer did not rotate his body enough, and he landed right on top of his head. And that's a big dude with a lot of weight coming down on that head. The referee checked on him immediately. He rolled out to the floor. He was being looked at by the doctor to see if he could continue. He got back inside so that Eddie could roll him up and pin him, so they quickly improvised a finish to get out of there. I don't think he needed to get back in there at all. I mean, if the referee had stopped the match due to injury, everybody saw what happened. Everybody knew how serious, you know, potentially it was. I don't think anybody would have cared. I think people would have understood. You know, when you're dealing with a possible neck injury, you don't take any chances. After the show, Archer tweeted that he was okay, and he said, "Listen, we choose to do this and take our health and lives in our hands every night. I have done that move hundreds of times over my career. I just under-rotated. Could have been much worse. Thank you to all at AEW for taking amazing care of me and protecting me. I will be back. Hopefully it's nothing too serious." Dan Lambert and the Men of the Year were in the ring cutting a promo on the Inner Circle Jerk. Sammy Guevara came out and called Lambert a fat-faced dipshit. Boy, the cuss words were flying here in this segment. I think they're competing with themselves to see how many cuss words they can fit in a single segment when we get the Inner Circle and Lambert's crew on TV. Lambert said at Full Gear they're going to have that 10-man tag match that Jericho asked for, if and only if Sammy puts his TNT title on the line this Wednesday against Ethan Page. And if Guevara loses, not only does he lose his TNT championship, but he must leave the Inner Circle forever. And Guevara accepted on the condition that if he wins, the Inner Circle gets to choose which members of America's Funniest Videos. He gets to choose which members of American Top Team they get to face at Full Gear, which makes me think maybe we're going to get Lambert in the ring. The heels walked up the ramp. They were going to go after Sammy on stage. The other members of the Inner Circle ran out to fight them off, all except for Jericho, who is on his cruise. He is on the high seas. If it wasn't for COVID, there would have been live Dynamite matches on the ship back in February when it was originally scheduled. I remember being on the cruise last year, and they said, next year we're going to do Dynamite matches on the ship. And, things didn't exactly turn out that way for various reasons. There was a backstage promo. He was in a darkened room somewhere with Jon Moxley that I thought was actually quite great. And he talked about how he's supposed to be yelling and screaming and getting all fired up about this World Title Eliminator tournament, but he's not thinking about that. He's thinking about his daughter, his newborn daughter. And he told a story about putting his broken pinky finger out and how she grabbed onto it and was holding onto it for dear life. And he said when he's with her, he realizes that none of this other stuff matters. Not the tournament, not the AEW World Title, not social media, not the ratings, not the demo. None of it matters. What he cares about is getting home in one piece for his family. All the teeth in his mouth. And in order for that to happen, other people have to get hurt. So his message to everybody in the tournament is, I'll get you before you get me. A man talking about the bond between father and daughter does not strike me as having the makings of a heel turn, unless he is not letting on exactly how much the AEW title really does matter to him, and then when he loses, he finally snaps. It could still happen. It could still have. The Jon Moxley heel turn could still happen. This was definitely not a heel promo, though. This was great stuff. This felt real. I liked him bringing the family. I liked him bringing the daughter into it. Jungle Boy beat Brandon Cutler. After the match, Jungle Boy grabbed the mic and he said that was a nice little warm-up. I'm feeling pretty good, though, for another match. I could go again. And he called out any of the elite pieces of shit to come down to the ring. That's the most fire I've heard out of Jungle Boy on the mic his entire career in AEW. And when none of them came out, he put the snare trap on Cutler again. And finally, Adam Cole comes out. Adam Cole has fast become my favorite part of the Elite. I have grown to not stand a lot of the other members, and Adam Cole is my favorite of all the members. He's the one that I like and I can tolerate the most. He called Jungle Boy an embarrassment. He said that they could have a fight right here and now. And he came down to the ring. He got punched off the apron. But the Young Bucks were behind Jungle Boy. He turned around right into a double super kick. They dragged him to the top of the ramp. They hit the BTE trigger. And Cole then lowered the boom to the back of the head. They all then grabbed Jungle Boy and they threw him off stage. He took this great bump through two tables down below. He laid there like he was dead. And obviously they're setting up for Jungle Boy against Adam Cole at Full Gear. And in the main event, we had Cody Rhodes against Malakai Black to complete the trilogy. I was hoping that they would put Black over Cody in their second match. He won the first match. That was great. Then they said they're going to have a second match. And I said, you know what they should do? They should have Malakai Black win again. And they did. Even though he had a cheat to do it, but he still won. I had no illusions about who was winning match number three. With the redemption story they've been telling with Cody on TV, I knew exactly who was going to win this match. I was hoping I'd be wrong, but I knew who was winning this match. So they went with the redemption story, and they went with the babyface win. It did not get the reaction that I'm sure they were all hoping for. Cody went for the figure four. Black gouged his eyes, rolled to the floor. He grabbed the chair, he threw it into the ring. Lee Johnson and Brock Anderson are coming down to the ring. And at that point, they go to commercial. During the break, they actually did a big spot during the break. Cody hit a crossroads off the apron through a table at ringside. So they come back, they show us a replay of what we missed. I mean, it was picture in picture, but if you missed it, they showed it again. While the camera was focused on Arn Anderson in the ring, he was in the ring for the distraction because Cody and Black were outside. Very clearly, they were blading themselves because they both came up bleeding, wouldn't you know? But it took forever, so the camera was focused the entire time on armed Anderson in the ring. Here comes Andrade down to the ring, and he does the Glock Anderson pose, the gun-firing pose with his hand. His assistant, Jose, is in the ring. Arn Anderson doesn't realize it. Jose has the laptop. And as he charges in at Arn Anderson, Arn grabs Jose. He gives him a spine buster. And as soon as Arn gets back up to his feet, though, Malakai is there with the black mist to the face. Down goes armed Anderson. Pac comes out. He and Andrade brawl to the back. The crowd is going nuts during all of this. Malakai hits a springboard moonsault. Cody, though, pops up and hits a crossroads for a near fall. And again, the crowd at this point is loud, and they are completely 100% behind Malakai Black. Now, remember, when I talked about this a few weeks ago, the possibility that maybe Cody might go heel, I forgot what city they were. Actually, it might have been New York when they were at Arthur Ashe. And Cody got booed. And I said, well, it's New York. I don't know that this necessarily means Cody is going heel, because he's talked about the fact, look, I'm not going heel. I'm not trying to swerve everybody. It's just not something I'm interested in. I'm a dad now, and I've got these different reality shows that I'm doing. I'm not going heel. And a lot of people said, oh, sure. But he got booed in New York, and I said, let's wait and see what the reaction is in other cities. Because maybe he got booed in New York City, but they go to, you know, North Carolina, and they go to Boston, and they go to Orlando or Chicago, and they go to these other places, and maybe he gets cheered like a babyface. Let's just see how the fans react to him in other cities. And they were in Orlando last night. You could add Orlando to the list with New York. These people booed Cody the entire time. Almost anything he did, they booed. And they cheered Malakai Black like he was the conquering babyface. So we have our answer as far as whether or not it was just isolated to New York. But he hit the black mass kick. Cody fell into the ropes. He was lying there dead on the bottom rope. Malakai was trying to get him back to the center of the ring. Cody went out to the floor. He avoided a moonsault. He hit a tope through the ropes. Back inside, he hit the Cody cutter and the crossroads. And it looked like he was about to hit a pedigree. But he hit the Tiger Driver 98 instead, and he got the pin. Cody wins the finale, but he does not win the feud. Just based on sheer numbers, Black has two wins over him. Cody only has one. But now Black can move on. There's no need to continue this. Black can move on to something else. This does not need to, you know, go any further. It doesn't kill him or anything like that. I would not have beaten Malakai Black. And based on the crowd reaction, they wouldn't have beaten him either. They wanted badly to see him win. But Cody wanted his redemption story, so he got it. It was a fun match. And the crowd was hot for it. But I have to say, if the idea of this Roads to the Top show that they're doing was to get Cody and Brandy over as big baby faces, it has been a colossal failure so far. And actually, it's been a colossal failure, period, because they just aired the season finale of Roads to the Top, which I didn't watch. And you look at the reaction that Cody got last night. Yeah, I would say that if even part of the idea was that maybe it would get them over as bigger baby faces, then I don't see how you can see this as anything other than a fail. Now, on Dynamite this Wednesday in Boston, Sammy Guevara defends the TNT title against Ethan Page. CM Punk one-on-one against Bobby Fish. The Dark Order take on the Elite. And this, by the way, is going to be the Halloween episode. So you're going to have a lot of people dressed up in costumes, cosplaying as, God knows who. TBS title tournament match, Serena Deeb one-on-one against Hikaru Shida. And Jon Moxley takes on Preston Vance, number 10 of the Dark Order in the World Title Eliminator. On Rampage this upcoming Friday, World Title Eliminator Bryan Danielson one-on-one against Eddie Kingston, and Leo Rush teams up with Dante Martin to take on Mike and Matt Sydal. I can already tell that is going to be an impossible match to take notes on. So it's different when you're just watching the show or you're trying to actually keep some notes on at least some of the moves and some of the spots. That match is going to be a challenge. But those are the lineups for this upcoming week. This week's episode is brought to you by BetterHelp, affordable private online therapy that can start helping you right now. The place to go is betterhelp.com/solomonster. I got a great response from you guys when I mentioned this last week, which is awesome. Not just because they're a sponsor of the show, which is great, but because I know it's a resource that can actually help a lot of people. If there is something that is stopping you from achieving your goals or something that's interfering with your happiness, BetterHelp will match you with your own licensed professional therapist, and you could have communication going between the two of you in less than 48 hours. It's that quick. BetterHelp is not a crisis line. It's not a self-help resource. These are professional counselors who are trained to do this for a living, done safely and securely online. You send a message to your counselor at any time. You can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, all without having to sit in a waiting room somewhere around other people. I mean, look, it's understandable that that can make some people feel awkward, especially if they've never spoken with a therapist before, if you've never gone to therapy before, and you go for the first time, and you're sitting in someone's office, and there's other people sitting and staring, you're all looking at each other, trying to figure out, I wonder what that guy's problem is, I wonder what that woman's issue is. This takes all of that, all the awkwardness is completely removed from the process. And when you visit betterhelp.com/solomonster, you'll answer a series of questions to help match you with the right therapist for your needs without limiting yourself only to the people who live near you. They have licensed counselors that specialize in depression, stress, anxiety, LGBT matters, self-esteem issues, sleep problems. It's affordable, and anything you share is completely confidential. We all have issues in our lives, some more serious than others. There is no shame in asking for help. And that's why BetterHelp exists, to extend a hand to people who need someone to talk to. They really do help people, and they can help you too. Start living a happier life today. As a listener of The Sound Off, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/solomonster. Join the over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/solomonster. We have 2 days until Halloween Havoc. NXT had its go-home show on Tuesday. I love how, because they want to appear hip and cool for the younger audience, Vic Joseph and Wade Barrett now dress like hipsters at an internet cafe. It looks like Johnny Gargano is back to being a babyface. He interrupted a segment with the new North American champion, Carmelo Hayes, and Trick Williams talked about Austin Theory being on Raw and Indy Hartwell being married and his wife being pregnant. He's done with all the fun now. He has lost his way. It's time to get back on track. And he challenged Carmelo Hayes to a title match. And Williams said that Gargano needs to worry about his daughter, referring to Indy Hartwell. Said that Hartwell has been shooting into Melo's DMs all week, is what the champion said. And Gargano was just kind of playing along to all this. And all of a sudden, we had Dexter Lumis appeared, and he snuck up behind Trick Williams and put him in a choke. And Hayes dragged Williams out of the ring. So it looks like we're going to get a tag team match soon, and then Gargano is going to be challenging for the North American title. Later in the show, Hayes realized that his North American title was missing. And he and Williams found a note inside of a locker that had a bunch of Halloween decorations and lights inside of it, inviting them to a haunted house hosted by Dexter Lumis at Halloween Havoc. It's not enough that we have people being kidnapped every other week on this show. Now property is being abducted as well. Imperium got a win over the Creed brothers from Diamond Mine, but it was a cheap roll-up win after interference by Kushida and Ikemenjiro. MSK ran in to attack Imperium after the match and indicated that they wanted to defend their tag team titles against them at Halloween Havoc. I don't think Imperium can really afford another loss. They won here, but we've been seeing them, I feel like, losing more than winning. I just think you save the tag team title change, though, for the Creed brothers, and you have them be the ones to bring in more gold to Diamond Mine. Meanwhile, the boos continue to rain down for MSK, and I have been trying to figure out what happened that has caused people to turn against these two guys. And now, we have one possible answer. Bodyslam.net posted a story yesterday that mentioned a recent Reddit post suggesting they're being booed because of an old tweet that Nash Carter posted, one half of MSK, 3 years ago, criticizing a then 13-year-old Izzy. Remember Izzy, the young Bayley superfan from the Full Sail days of NXT? Now she's involved with different independent wrestling promotions and she's doing commentary, she's managed people. I said at the time, you know, one day, watch, Izzy is going to grow up and she's going to beat the fuck out of Bayley. I said, you got to watch that girl. But the belief, according to this report, the belief, and this again stems from some Reddit posts, and it's not just Reddit posts, obviously Bodyslam.net followed up on this. The belief is that Izzy's parents held a grudge against the guy for whatever it was that I couldn't find the tweet, but whatever it was that he tweeted, maybe he took it down. And they got a group of fans at the CWC to boo them and get very vocal whenever MSK would walk out. Now, even if it's only a handful of people, they have maybe 150 people in the audience. I mean, now they can fit a little bit more than they could before. It's not a lot of people, though, in that building at the Performance Center. So all you really need to do is get a few people who are loud enough. They can make a lot of noise. And it can almost seem like the entire crowd is booing. Now, Bodyslam.net claims to have sources that have told them that there is truth to the report. They say that her parents, as well as the group of fans they convinced to join in on the booing, were asked to move off the hard camera side because they could be seen booing the team when they came out. Here's more of the report. Go back and watch NXT before TakeOver Stand and Deliver. Their posse is on the hard cam every show, according to one source. After TakeOver, a decision was made to move them off the hard cam because of the booing of MSK, but by then the crowd had been ingrained to boo them because it was the cool thing to do. The group cannot be seen in their usual spot in the audience in the episodes of NXT following Stand and Deliver, and reportedly moved away from the main camera's view following the event. Now, this is where the report gets pretty nutty, but given how insane some wrestling fans are, I can absolutely believe it. One source even said that they had overheard a member of the group that was not Izzy or her parents suggest that they should chant "Your dad's dead" to Carter after the NXT superstar had been vocal on social media about the 12th anniversary of his father's passing in February. NXT officials were reportedly notified of the comment by a nearby audience member. That is just batshit crazy. But it makes about as much sense as any other explanation that I've tried to come up with for why these two guys suddenly started getting booed on TV. You know, you could say, well, maybe the crowd turned against them too much too soon. I don't get that sense. It's almost like it just started happening and then it just snowballed from there. Again, like the crowd picked up on it being the cool thing to do, but like I can never figure out what it was that they did or what it was that they said that would have led to people booing them so much. And now it looks like we might have an answer. We got a wacky training skit in the woods with Kyle O'Reilly and Von Wagner running with logs and playing lumberjack by taking an axe to a tree. Paul Bunyan over here. They shared a beer at the end of this. I still think this pairing is very awkward, but the vignette was entertaining enough. There was a triple threat match with one member of each of the three women's teams fighting each other at Halloween Havoc to decide who would spin the wheel to choose the stipulation for the match this Tuesday. Spinning the wheel gives you no discernible advantage over your opponents, so I don't know why it even matters who spins the wheel. Seems kind of stupid to me. Io Shirai versus Persia Parada versus JC Jane. Unfortunately, there was a bad botch and an injury to Jane when she tried a suicide dive through the ropes and her feet got caught on the middle rope. And she crashed straight down on her face. And her arm and her shoulder, and she tried to continue, but she could not. She left the match midway through. You know, that happened once on a spot on Raw, actually, in a match. Because it could happen to anybody. But you do see people in NXT who don't have as much experience. It is the developmental show now. You know, when they try certain things, it kind of makes you cringe. This, though, is just such a basic spot at this point. Every fucking person does a suicide dive in every match. You don't really even think anything of it anymore. I've ranted enough on dives. I mean, you know my thoughts on this. But it happened once before on Raw, Sasha Banks against Asuka. Remember that? I mean, scared the hell out of me. Sasha was coming out of the ring, and I think her feet got caught on the middle rope, and she just went straight down. And it was a miracle that she didn't break her neck. But she left the match. I have not heard or read anything further about her condition or what her status is for Tuesday. To their credit, Io and Persia, they did a good job of adjusting on the fly and finishing the match, which saw Io pick up the win with her moonsault. So Io spun the wheel, and it landed on Stairway to Hell ladder match. So there is your stipulation for the women's tag team title match on Tuesday. Tony D'Angelo is back in action, picking up a quick win over newcomer Ru Feng. Samantha Irvin interviewed D'Angelo in the ring after the match, and she noted that Lash Legends producer went missing, and she wanted to know if Tony had anything to do with that or knew anything about it. And D'Angelo asked her if she's a snitch and said that he doesn't know anything. And D'Angelo gave her a wad of cash and told her to go get something nice for yourself and forget about it. This guy's fucking great. LA Knight beat Grayson Waller to win the right to host Halloween Havoc. This is why LA Knight went undrafted, so that he could play host. Like he's fucking Pat Sajak. This is why he went undrafted. Tommaso Ciampa and Bron Breakker did the Can They Coexist deal in the main event, which we got multiple times, in fact, on TV this week, because they did it again with Drew McIntyre and Big E, who were openly mocking the whole Can They Coexist thing. So now they're mocking their own stupid booking. Twice in 1 week with this. Can They Coexist? They beat the grizzled young veterans in the main event. Breakker looked great here. He picked up the win for his team. I'm a Bron Breakker guy. Not the name. But this guy is going places. This leads me to my Halloween Havoc preview and predictions. Let's run this card down. I'll let you know my predictions as we go along. We are getting the debut of that newcomer Solo Sikoa. We got another vignette for him on Tuesday, so he'll be there on Halloween Havoc. MSK. Boo! There, see, I did it. MSK against Imperium. Spin the wheel, make the deal for the NXT Tag Team Championship. I'm going to go with MSK for the win, because I think they drop them to the Creed Brothers at the next TakeOver show. If we even get any more TakeOver show, I'm just assuming here we're going to get TakeOver at some point. Maybe they call it something different. Maybe we're not getting takeovers anymore. They have not said anything about any upcoming takeover shows. Whatever the next big show is, maybe it's a big TV show. I think that's where they drop the belts. I would have them drop them to the Creed brothers. So MSK retains here. Triple threat, Scareway to Hell ladder match for the NXT Women's Tag Team titles. Io Shirai and Zoe Stark defend against Indy Hartwell and Persia Parada. And Gigi Dolin and JC Jane, if she's physically able to. Ladder matches with some of the less experienced names can be very dangerous. I mean, they're dangerous even with the more experienced names. People get hurt in ladder matches all the time. But when you have people who are in developmental who are not as experienced, I will be holding my breath a lot during this match. Toxic Attraction has been getting the big push on TV. I think Gigi and JC win the titles. Again, if JC is okay to physically go in there. Spin the Wheel, Make the Deal for the NXT Women's Championship with Mandy Rose challenging Raquel Gonzalez. I don't think it's going to be a clean sweep for Toxic Attraction. I think Raquel is going to retain. And Tommaso Ciampa defends the NXT Championship against Bron Breakker. If it's me, I put the title on Bron Breakker, and I let him rip, and just see how he does. Because what the fuck do you have to lose? I mean, really. What do you have to lose? This guy is the most entertaining thing on the entire show. So why not? He's going to be on the main roster. I mean, within a year, if he's not on the main roster, I'd be shocked. Because I don't think they're going to be able to resist. I think by the next draft, if not sooner, I think we're going to see him on Raw or SmackDown. So let's find out how he does when he's got a championship to defend. And you have a whole brand built around this guy. Let's see how he does. But I don't think they're going to do it. I don't think they're actually going to pull the trigger on it. All he needs to do is go in there and hang with Ciampa and show that he belongs. And I think he's going to do just fine. Prediction-wise, I think Tommaso Ciampa retains. I don't think they have the balls to put that title on Bron Breakker just yet. Maybe they'll prove me wrong. But I think Ciampa is going to retain. Dark Side of the Ring this week was Extreme and Obscene, the story of Rob Black's XPW, Extreme Pro Wrestling. They have really gone in heavy on the deathmatch stuff this season with the Nick Gage episode, Onita and FMW, and now XPW. You had Rob Zicari, better known as Rob Black, who directed porn movies, combining his love of porn and pro wrestling together to form XPW in 1999, which clearly borrowed from ECW, the spirit of ECW. It served as something of a West Coast version of ECW, based out of Southern California. I didn't watch XPW back then. I knew of the New Jack Vic Grimes scaffold match, and I vividly remember reading about the Messiah incident. Both subjects are covered on this episode. Black was not interviewed for the show because, as Messiah, I think it was, said, it's a no-win situation for him. He really doesn't have anything to be gained by agreeing to be interviewed for this. Instead, he recorded his own podcast talking about the show and rebutting some of the things that were said about him. They talked about some of the really stupid shit that some of the XPW guys did on their shows. Luke Hawks did a 450 off a balcony through a table with thumbtacks, and the tacks were just buried so deep into his skin, he had to use a pair of pliers to pull them all out. Another time, there was an infamous flaming table spot where someone brought charcoal fluid to the show. They went out, they were supposed to get lighter fluid. Instead, they got charcoal fluid, which is oil-based. Lighter fluid is what they usually use. It burns up real quick. And Supreme, who was a legend in deathmatch wrestling and a big star in XPW, he died of a heart attack last year. He ended up on fire. And they have this footage of him running around, rolling out of the ring on fire. Flames are on him. And he's running around the ringside area screaming. He's just agonizing, trying to put the flames out. His flesh is just all burnt up and it's hanging off. It's just disgusting. They mentioned that Rob Black had struck up a deal with Paul Heyman, to bring ECW to the West Coast. But when ECW got national TV on TNN, all of a sudden they didn't have a need for XPW anymore. And this did not sit very well with Rob Black, who held a grudge. And this eventually led to the little XPW publicity stunt at ECW's Heatwave pay-per-view in 2000, which they held in XPW's backyard, Los Angeles, right? ECW went out west for the Heatwave show. Several XPW stars had seats in the front row that Rob Black had bought for them. He bought like hundreds of dollars, I think, worth of tickets for the front row. And so they're sitting there, and they caused a commotion at the start of the main event between Tommy Dreamer and Justin Credible, and they were all ejected from the building. So they're out in the parking lot. A giant brawl breaks out. They didn't even get into the specifics on the episode, but a lot of fans knew that there was a fight going on outside, and so they ran out to go see it, which kind of killed the main event that was happening in the ring. New Jack on the episode, and boy, are they lucky they interviewed him when they did. He talked about being out there in the brawl, and I think he had just had knee surgery or something, so he had a crutch, and he's beating the hell out of one of the XPW ring crew guys with a crutch. The following year, ECW folded, and XPW brought in some of their big names, like Terry Funk and Shane Douglas and New Jack and Sabu. All New Jack wanted to do was make money and watch porn. So he was more than happy to go work for XPW, and he claimed that Rob Black actually let him ride a forklift around his warehouse to help grab all of the porn DVDs that he wanted to watch. Austin drove a Zamboni to the ring. New Jack drove a forklift loaded with porn. Sounds about right. They covered New Jack's scaffold match in XPW against Vic Grimes. If you missed the New Jack episode of Dark Side of the Ring, he and Grimes had a match previously in ECW where Grimes landed on New Jack's head on a balcony dive spot. He hesitated at the last minute. He didn't want to do it. And New Jack said, "Motherfucker, you're coming down with me." And they come off, and Grimes was a big dude, and he landed right on New Jack's head. And he fractured New Jack's skull. He had vision loss, and it was a very bad injury. And New Jack never forgave him for that. And actually, I think he totally lost the vision in one of his eyes. He never forgave Vic Grimes, so he had nothing but revenge on his mind from the day that he got hurt. He was out for blood. Rob Black is the one who came up with the idea of matching them up in a scaffold match. And he wanted to flip a coin to decide who would be the one to be thrown off. And New Jack told him point blank, he goes, "Grimes is going off, regardless of what the coin flip says. He's going off. I'm launching him off that scaffold." And they showed this scaffold, and it's way up there. And it's swaying back and forth. And you don't have a lot of room to maneuver when you're in one of these scaffold matches, which is why I've never been a fan of them. New Jack, in the middle of it, pulls out a stun gun and uses it for real on Vic Grimes. And then he grabs him. And you remember what New Jack said, bombs away. He throws Vic Grimes off the scaffold. And that Vic Grimes bump off the scaffold is still the scariest bump that I have ever seen in my life. The man was inches away from death. If he had just landed over a little bit more, he'd have splatted on the pavement and that would have been the end of him. As it was, he somehow crashed through all of some of the stacked up tables that were in the ring, bounced off the top rope, and landed in the corner of the ring. And New Jack said when he got to the back, Rob told him he thought it was great. He gave him a bonus. And New Jack felt, well, I got my revenge, so mission accomplished. And that was his last match for XPW. Mission accomplished actually isn't accurate. His goal was to kill Vic Grimes. He has said he wanted to kill him. He didn't want to hurt him. He didn't want to maim him. He wanted to kill him. He was aiming for the ground. So in that regard, he failed. Rob Black does not come out of this looking good, but I mean, all you need to do is read up on the guy. There's no way he wasn't going to come out of this episode looking good. Luke Hawks told a story about Black chewing him out backstage at a show for putting his hands up to protect himself on a chair shot to the head. And he said, "We don't do that here." Which Black adamantly denies on his podcast. He says it's bullshit, that never happened. To that, I say, let's just ask Jerry Lynn, because Luke Hawks in the episode says that Jerry Lynn was right there when it all went down, and Jerry Lynn pulled him aside and told him, hey, look, don't listen to him. He doesn't know what he's saying. Ignore what he said. So let's ask Jerry Lynn. Jerry Lynn's working for AEW these days behind the scenes. If Jerry Lynn says that it happened, I will take his word over Rob Black's. And according to Luke, Rob got back at him the next time by booking an angle where his hands were cuffed. He had him, I don't know what he was hanging from, but he was cuffed. His arms were outstretched like Jesus Christ. And Black told, now this is him telling the story. This is Luke Hawk's version of the story. He says that Rob Black told Supreme to destroy him with chair shots to the skull. Now he's cuffed, so he can't protect himself. And they had the footage and they showed it. They showed, it's just, it's sickening. That was his punishment for daring to protect himself by putting a hand up on a chair shot. But the most insane story is the Messiah story. And it was great that they got Messiah to be interviewed for this. Obviously, he's retired. He's not wrestling anymore. He's got a wife and a family now, kids. He was their top star at the time, very young, early 20s, and there were rumors about Messiah hooking up with Rob's wife, Lizzie Borden, behind his back. And Rob wanted to kill him when he found out about it. He was so livid. That spelled the end of Messiah in XPW. Now, he claims he got a phone call later on from Rob warning him that he had 3 days to get out of town or he was a dead man. And Messiah told him, I'm not running. I'm not getting on a bus and going somewhere. I'm right here. I'm not going nowhere. So Messiah works a show for Epic Pro Wrestling in 2002. New Jack actually worked that show that night also. He was shooting on Rob Black and XPW. And in the course of his shooting, New Jack mentioned that Messiah slipped Rob's wife the ding dong. Later on, when Messiah came out, he is showered with chants of, you fucked Lizzie, you fucked his wife. And Messiah, being young and dumb, admitted it publicly for the first time. He had never responded, or in interviews that he did, he denied that there was any truth to any of this. So this was the first time that he admitted the fact that he had sex with Rob Black's wife. He responded by saying, and she fucking loved it. Because up to that point, he had always denied it. But he said, I'm not going to be intimidated by Rob Black. That was his mindset. That was his attitude at that time. I'm not going to let this guy and his threats and his phone calls intimidate me. And Messiah got a little full of himself. Messing around with another guy's wife, I mean, let alone your boss's wife, is a pretty fucking stupid thing to be doing. I think we can all admit. There are no innocent parties here. Everybody comes out of this looking scummy. A few weeks later, there was an XPW show forever known as the Beach Ball Show. It was a terrible show. The crowd just completely hijacked it. There were beach balls being bounced around all over the place. And Messiah attended the show with a friend. Rob Black didn't know this. When things started getting out of control, he decided to leave. But word got back to Rob that Messiah was there. And he was furious. And what happened next was crazy enough that it ended up on an episode of America's Most Wanted. Less than 2 weeks after that show, Messiah had just bought a Nintendo GameCube, and he was at home, he was playing the video game. Two men walk into his apartment. They open the door, they walk into the apartment. He didn't think anything of it at first because he had a roommate. He just thought that they were friends of the roommate. So he didn't even bother like turning around to see who it was. In fact, he said that he just kind of looked over and said, oh, hey, what's up? As soon as he saw, though, in the reflection of the TV, one of them locking the door behind him, he knew something was up. He goes to turn around. They immediately grab him. They take him, you know, they tackle him to the ground. One guy has Messiah in a chokehold. It's not applied very well, but he's trying to choke him, or at least subdue him in a chokehold. The other guy grabs Messiah's right hand. He pulls out a pair of garden shears, and he proceeds to cut off Messiah's thumb. It just popped right off. And they reenacted it here in this episode. I don't, that was something else. They tried to cut off his other thumb. They were reaching for the other hand. They wanted to cut off the other thumb. He balled his hand into a fist, so they couldn't get to it. They grabbed a fish tank in the apartment and smashed it over Messiah's head. They were trying to knock him out. I mean, they knocked the guy out. They can cut off pretty much anything they want. Instead, he staggers over to the front door. He can't open it, though. He can't unlock it because he doesn't have a fucking thumb. He's just kind of pawing away at the door, and there's blood all over the door. Now, he didn't mention this in the episode, but he did tell America's Most Wanted in 2002 that his thumbs were not the only part of his anatomy that they tried to cut off. They tried to get his pants off. And while he cannot be sure what they were trying to do, he can't say for sure, it sure sounds like they were hoping to cut off his dick. Which, if you think about it, I mean, given what he did, I mean, that kind of would make sense if somebody did send, you know, these two guys after him to punish him for some, I'm just saying, to punish him for something, that would seem like something that you might want them to do. He claims that he managed to get an armbar on one of the guys and he got the door open somehow and then the two guys ran out. I remember reading that he was stabbed multiple times when they couldn't get his pants off. So it's like how he would then have been able to get an armbar on one of the guys, that I don't know. That almost sounds to me like that's classic kind of wrestler embellishing there, but I don't know. He was searching around for the thumb after to try to put it on ice, to try to save it. He couldn't find the thumb because they took the thumb with them. To this day, the case is considered unsolved. They never did find the thumb. They never did identify the attackers. And nor has Rob Black ever been arrested or charged in connection with the attack. Obviously, he denies having anything to do with it. I mean, look, you can make up your own mind about whether or not he had anything to do with what happened, but it's never been proven. Black and his wife ended up going to prison. Not for that. Didn't have anything to do with that, but they went to prison on obscenity charges that were tied to the distribution of the adult films that they were making and that they were selling that depicted simulated rape scenes, among other things. He was all over television during this time doing interviews. I mean, on like mainstream network television, Nightline, and you know, all these different shows defending the movies that he was making and his right to them and you know, First Amendment rights and that kind of stuff. And he was daring the Attorney General, who was John Ashcroft at the time. He was the Attorney General of the U.S. and he was basically daring him to come after him and try to stop him. Not a very bright move on his part to challenge the federal government and say, just bring it. Well, guess what happened? They just brought it. They came after him and they ended up getting him. And he and his wife were facing up to 50 years in prison, potentially millions of dollars in fines. They each ended up serving a year and a day behind bars on one charge. He and his wife split shortly after they got out of prison. Today, he's married, he's got a few kids, he's running a cheeseburger shop, but he's also promoting a rebirth now for XPW. And they're running their first show in New York on November 7th. They're holding an 8-man tournament to crown a new XPW champion. And they have some names that they're advertised. I mean, some names for the show. Rhino, Brian Cage, Willie Mack, Matt Cross, among others. So just like Onita, he too resurrected his promotion this year. Onita brought FMW back as FMWE, doing exploding deathmatch stuff in vegetable markets in Japan. And now XPW, he's going to give it another go. I guess what's old is new again, it seems. But that was basically the crux of the entire episode. I mean, it was an extreme deathmatch promotion that pushed a lot of boundaries, that incorporated a lot of sex appeal, a lot of sex, period. But the Messiah story to me was always the craziest thing I've ever really associated with XPW. I mean, that to me is just, that's just beyond insane. This Thursday is the season finale covering the steroid trials for George Zahorian and a fellow by the name of Vince McMahon. Saving the juiciest for last, I see. And and I'll have a review up for that at some point next weekend. Let's take a few questions here and get the hell out of here. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Cordell from Milton, Delaware. If you were a wrestling manager today, who would the Solomonster be the mouthpiece for and why? Keith Lee. Or should I say Bearcat Lee? I'd say Keith Lee. I want to see Keith Lee do well. I think I put my all into it. If Keith Lee is going to be a heel, like a monster heel, I could be a mouthpiece for him. Put the guy over as much as I possibly can. I think Keith Lee's promos are very much hit or miss. I don't like when he was called up to the main roster and he was doing a lot of that greetings and salutations. I thought, why is he speaking like this? This is not a good promo cadence. Maybe he shouldn't be doing his own promos. Maybe he should just be going out there and killing dudes and having somebody else do the talking for him. And I'm not even saying that I would be the best at it, but I tell you what, man, I'd go out there and give it my all and try to get this fucker over as much as I can and just do my part. He could do his part in the ring. I'd like to try to help out Keith Lee and see him do well. Clark from Medicine Hat, Alberta. I hated when WWE got rid of King of the Ring after 2002. Why do you think they got rid of it as a pay-per-view? I have always been of the impression that it just didn't do as well, buy rate-wise, as their other shows did. Bruce Pritchard on his podcast has said that Vince McMahon just didn't like it. He didn't like the concept, it didn't perform well, and he just got tired of it. He wanted to change it up. So there you go. Jerome in Sin City, USA. If Desert Storm never happened, then Sergeant Slaughter would not have turned heel. What would the main event have been of WrestleMania 7? I've got to think Hogan Warrior 2 with Hogan going over. And they were not happy. Vince McMahon, I guess, was not happy about Warrior's performance as champion. The ultimate goal was to, no pun intended, the ultimate goal was to get the belt back on Hogan. I think they would have just built up a big marquee rematch between the two, and this time the result would have been different and you would have had the belt on Hogan. If they wanted the belt on Hulk and Warrior was the champion, then that would have been the only way to do it, because if you take the belt off Warrior, let's say, and put it on Macho King, then you end up with Macho Man against Hogan at WrestleMania. What does Warrior do? So I think it would have just been Hogan and Warrior. Christopher from East London, buy or sell on two incredible matches that do not get talked about nearly enough. Triple H against Shawn Michaels against Chris Benoit at Backlash in 2004. Or Kurt Angle against The Undertaker, No Way Out, 2006. Which, in your opinion, is the better match? I remember more about Undertaker and Kurt Angle than I do the other triple threat. I do remember that being an excellent match. I think they're very comparable, honestly. I mean, I would probably... I mean, it's been so long since I've seen that triple threat. I think both of those are, you know, at least 4.5. If not higher, 4.5 star matches. If you want to assign a star rating to it, I think you flip a coin, honestly. But if it's me personally, the match that I enjoyed more and remember more, it's Angle against Undertaker. You could have had Kurt Angle against The Undertaker for the world title at WrestleMania 22 that year. But they said Vince McMahon just didn't want to do it. Email me your questions, thesolomonster@gmail.com. I will be doing more of them. I wanted to make sure I got a few of them in here. I know I responded to some of you directly. For those of you who may have missed it, because I put it up after I did last week's show, I did record a movie review for Halloween Kills. I did see the new Halloween film, and so my review is up on the YouTube channel. I did push the audio out to the feed as well, if you prefer that. But please do check that out and give that a like if you do check it out on YouTube. I will be back with you on YouTube on Wednesday night because Dynamite is back in its normal slot. So Wednesday night after 10 p.m., I'll be live, as I will be after Rampage this upcoming Friday. And then next Sunday, Halloween Day, episode 728 of The Sound Off. A very special Halloween edition. Next weekend of the show, so I hope you'll join me then. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a fantastic week, Thank you for all of your support with all of the content and all the streams and everything I've been doing and will continue to do as we head into the 14-year anniversary next month. Don't forget that t-shirt is also up on Pro Wrestling Tees. And I will see you back here for 728 on Halloween next Sunday. Take care, guys.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
Monday Night Raw is such an obnoxiously boring, uninspiring television show that if they want a hot shot of Money in the Bank cash in and a title change and try to put something exciting out there for a change, maybe it'll keep me from dozing off by hour three. The show is fucking awful.
The Sala Monster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Sala Monster on Twitter @SalaMonster.
Sala Monster. Sala Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Sala Monster sounds off.